Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of wildlife, and we'll be talking about some of the highlights, wildlife highlights of 2017 with you today. Scott Craven back with us. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. And beside the year in wildlife, we'll also talk about the Kirtland warbler, the moose population, the effects of sub-zero temperatures on wildlife. Maybe you spotted a Kirtland warbler this past year. Maybe you have some wildlife questions. I tell you what, we've had some problems with our 800 number. Our 800 number is not working today. And so we invite you to go to our Facebook page and you can post questions there. We also ask you to call in. There's a 608 number. The number is 608-263-6580. 608-263-6580. You can also send in an email with your questions or comments or sightings at ideas@wpr.org. So ideas@wpr.org. And again, that phone number is 608-263-6580. Happy New Year, Scott Craven.
Happy New Year to you, Larry, and all the listeners. Holy cow, it's great to be back here. I think it's been,
a while.
4 months since I was on, and I missed my, I guess it would have been the November show. I was planning on getting things geared up for the deer season, and as you know, I had a fairly long stint in the hospital, followed by 6 or 7 weeks of isolation at home, and it's just nice to be back as a member of society again.
Well, you're looking pretty perky, so it's good to see.
I feel pretty good. I think part of that psychological and just, I'm out. it's been great.
Well, then when you have to get out, then you walk right into some really bitter cold weather out there, and there's not much fun being outside for us or maybe for the wildlife.
Well, I mean, the good news is, although the last couple of weeks have been brutal, if you recall, I mean, back before Christmas, December ended up as a pretty warm month, and 2017 overall ended up as a very warm year. So, you know, up until just before Christmas, I was able to get out and walk around the house. I was supposed to do some walking because my, you know, I came home with a walker and couldn't really move around on my own, and it was great to get outside. But then we got blasted by this beastly cold, and it has hung around, and I guess it's going to hang around for a few more days. Bad on us, but something of a, well, I guess I'd say a mixed blessing as far as wildlife is concerned. On the one hand, the counterpart to the bitter cold, at least here in the southern part of the state, is relatively light snow. So the fields are still open. So as far as the deer and turkeys and whatever waterfowl are still around, finding food in the harvested fields is a little easier than it might be otherwise. But the bitter cold has all sorts of implications. So the waterfowl I mentioned pretty well cleared out a few days ago. I mean, I was seeing lots of geese around the house south of Madison, and literally everything's frozen up now. Even the Sugar River sealed up a few days ago, and
I know there were hundreds and hundreds of geese and some ducks, too, on Lake Monona up until just a few days ago.
So if for them, it's open water that's more important than the food sources. And once that open water is gone, they're gone. So I think we've seen the last of most of our waterfowl for a while. Although I did see some reports that there was some pretty pretty cool waterfowl viewing over along the Lake Michigan shoreline, where they were seeing some interesting scoters and harlequin ducks and long-tailed ducks and things like that. So there's still places to go to see a few of those things. And, of course, well, we'll talk about the eagle viewing a little later. But the real problem with the cold, and I think that people are well aware of that because of all the water main breaks we've been seeing in the Madison area and elsewhere across the state, is that with little snow cover to insulate the ground, the frost is going deep, and it's going deep very fast. And, okay, so it gets the water mains, but there are a lot of things down in the ground for the winter, amphibians and reptiles and assorted other things that hibernate underground that get caught up in this deep freeze, and that can be a real problem for them. So it may be a excuse me, it may be a bad winter for some of our amphibians. It's probably a good idea to keep those feeders full. If we do get some listeners.
Yeah, we actually have a caller online now with a feeder question.
Well, at least in the case of my feeders, since I've been trapped at home for 8 weeks, managing the feeders has been something I've taken up. And it's been, with this cold, it's been a great feeder. So the therapeutic value of being able to sit there and watch the birds and get to know some of them pretty well has been great. And I've been keeping them full. And the food, of course, the energy source is very important to the birds now. So keep those feeders full. And if you have questions about feeders, what you're seeing or what you're not seeing or anything else, then give us a call or send a message into the Facebook page or whatever. For me, it's been a great year for finches. Sometimes as many as 50 mixed goldfinches and house finches at the same time. 2 pairs of red-bellied woodpeckers, my favorite bird at the feeder, just beautiful. Lots of other woodpeckers. Not many cardinals this year. I wonder if other feeders are seeing that.
I haven't seen one.
In an ordinary year, just before dark, they're the last birds to come in during the day, and I might see as many as a dozen or more cardinals at a time. I'm lucky to see a single pair this year. Lots of juncos. A family of blue jays. It's very
English
entertaining.
English sparrows. I've got them by the hundreds.
Oh, well, but you're in town.
Yeah.
I haven't seen an English sparrow for probably 6 or 7 years now.
Wow.
Which is fine with me.
I'm sure it is.
But if people have feeder questions, that's an issue. So the bottom line is the cold weather, tough for us, tough for some of the wildlife, but the mixed blessing of low snow depth but deep frost kind of balancing each other off, we'll see what happens.
Dan in Duluth has a question relating to a feeder. Let's go to Dan. Thanks for calling, Dan.
Yeah, that was quite a segue. Thank you very much for leading right in perfectly into my question.
Sure. We try. We try.
we do have a squirrel feeder right outside our front windows in our house, and we enjoy a meal when they enjoy a meal. You know, we like to see them come up and enjoy the corn. However, we haven't seen any for quite a few days since this bitter cold has hit, and I was kind of wondering, do squirrels step into like a temporary hibernation, or do they hunker down until warmer weather comes around, or is it a mixture of both, or either one?
Are you asking about the squirrels or the birds or both?
Yeah, the squirrels.
A lot of the midsize, the other thing I didn't mention about the snow cover is that It's lack of snow cover, which may not be a problem up where you are, but it is.
No, it is not.
Is also a problem for our small mammals, the shrews and voles and mice and things like that, because they use the snow as cover. And when there's not much snow, they're vulnerable to predation, and they're exposed. The larger animals, from, say, squirrel size on up, the ones that are still generally active, possums, rabbits, squirrels, and so forth, tend to hunker down a little bit and just stay out of harm's way when it's really cold. So if the first day we get that breaks freezing or comes close, there'll be squirrels all over the place. The other issue with squirrels, at least down here, we had a fantastic nut crop this year. There were acorns and walnuts and hickory nuts everywhere. Even though I've got corn cob feeders out for the squirrels, and my wife dearly loves to see the squirrels, we haven't seen squirrel one probably since Thanksgiving.
Wow.
But
really?
But the woods, and again, because there's relatively little snow cover, those nuts are still exposed, and the squirrels have got plenty of food. So they're not reliant on the feeders now at all.
Yeah, we did experience that uptick in squirrel activity when the first snow hit, because they couldn't get to the acorns.
Yeah.
Well, they will when it's 20 below chill factor or worse, or actual temperature like that, it's in their best interest to hole up and conserve energy until they can get out under more moderate conditions. So I think when things moderate a little bit, you'll see your squirrels again.
Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you for taking my call. Good day.
Good day. Laura in Wisconsin Rapids, it's your turn. Hi, Laura.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
Scott, I'd like to congratulate you on your induction into the Wisconsin 4-H Hall of Fame. You were well represented at the induction by Justin and Max and Mark from Upham Woods, but we sure missed you. You've done a fantastic job of helping to educate all of us in Wisconsin about wildlife, and I think it's an honor well earned.
Well, thank you very much. I felt pretty badly that evening. Well, actually, I was still in the hospital at that point, so I didn't have much choice. I missed quite a few things over that span from late October through November, professional things like the induction into the 4-H Hall of Fame and, of course, things that I like to do like the hunting season. But anyway, that's behind me now. I appreciate your kind words. I'm sorry I wasn't there, but I know I had lots of good friends there to represent my interests and so forth, and I'm sorry I wasn't there, but I'm very happy and gratified to receive the honor.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, Laura. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, by the way. As I mentioned earlier, our 809 lines are not working, but we have a couple of local lines local to Madison. And you can call those lines, as you just heard. The number to call is 608-263-6580. 608-263-6580. And go ahead and call in. You know, Tori on Facebook says she just moved into a new house and was so happy to finally have a place to put her bird feeders up. And after about a week, she started getting nice mixes of songbirds. After about 2 weeks of seeing birds, they suddenly stopped coming to the feeders in the backyard. Would a hawk that's been hanging around be the reason the birds left? Is there anything she can do to bring them back?
The answer to that is yes and no. The yes part is that the presence of a hawk, a Cooper's hawk, for example, or any hawk that preys on birds, can quickly empty a feeder. The feeder birds catch on to that pretty quickly and just lie low in cover around my feeders, which I'm trying to think. I think I've got 9 up now on the various decks, and they can be covered with birds, and all of a sudden, boom, everything's gone. You wouldn't think there was a bird in the neighborhood. But we either then see the hawk flies by, or we just make the assumption, the hawk's here, and they eventually move on. Now, if you're unlucky enough to have one that's kind of taken up residence in a nice, comfortable evergreen or something on the corner of the yard, you're just going to have to grit your teeth and bear it. The presence of the hawk will cut down on feeder use, but eventually they'll move on too. If the birds stay low and they're not finding anything to eat, they'll move on to greener pastures. But there's really not much direct you can do. The hawks are just as protected legally as the songbirds are. And, if you see it perched, you can clap your hands or make it as uncomfortable as you can that the bird decides, hey, I'm going somewhere else. That might help, but that's
Seed out of the feeders for a while, and the birds go away.
You can shut things down. That's another good point, so that the birds leave anyway, and the hawk moves to some other feeder. So.
Yeah, there we go. Carol in Rice Lake, thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. I took part in the Christmas bird count last week, and the Rice Lake area with the Red Cedar River always has hundreds of geese that stay for the winter, and we saw lots of mergansers and wonderful birds. But I'm calling about a Canada goose that's been in a little pond on the foliage all by itself for probably the last 6 to 7 weeks. And my question is, would a goose wait for a mate if the mate was killed, or is it likely that this goose is injured?
That kind of waiting period would be more than would be expected to wait for a mate, family member, or what have you. That's a logical thought, and we saw many instances of it many years ago when I was banding geese at Horican Marsh. We'd catch a couple hundred geese in a net, and then they'd be brought to me one or two at a time. I'd band them, and then we'd sit them down on the ground, and most would fly away. But you know, maybe every 20th bird or every 40th bird, you'd sit the bird down, it would look around, and instead of flying away, it would just kind of run over to the side and stand there. And we'd let another bird go, and nothing would happen. Let four or five birds go, and nothing would happen. All of a sudden, you let the right bird go, mate or what have you, and they'd get together, and they were gone.
They were gone.
So
oh, really interesting.
The interesting thing is, I mean, they do know each other. To me, every Canada goose looked like every other Canada goose. Maybe one was bigger, one was smaller, but to tell an individual apart, nothing doing. But the birds know. But for the period you're talking about, much higher probability that that bird is in some way injured or compromised, and it's not going anywhere. And if that pond freezes, it's going to be in trouble, either freezing in or be accessible to a predator. So if it's still sitting there and the pond's closing in on it, maybe you can get a rehabilitator or, you know, someone local to maybe just see if it can be caught or if it can fly and then go from there.
Okay, because the space now is down to about 30 feet long by 6 feet wide that's still open.
Yeah,
and with the weather we're having, that's going to go quickly. So if you're concerned about the bird, I'd keep a close eye on it. And if you think you can get to it with a dip net or something else. Now, don't creep out on half-inch shelf ice to try and get the bird. That's going to put you or someone else at risk. But if things freeze up to the point that it leaves the water, and you can then net it, or if it flies away, well, you know, no harm, no foul. That's great. If it doesn't, then maybe you can get it taken care of.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Scott Craven, our guest today, as we take a look at the world of wildlife. You can join in, number to call, 608-263-6580, 608-263-6580. Let's go to Adam in Black River Falls. Adam, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Buddy and I were up in Black River Falls. We were camping last night, and we were wondering about how the elk population was doing, too, as well as the predatory animals in that area.
You were camping last night, eh? That attracted my attention immediately. Was it a little chilly?
It wasn't too bad. This morning was the worst part.
Getting out of the...
I was pretty chilly in the bedroom. I don't know, camping might have been out of the question. Anyway, in answer to your question, the elk herds, both up around Clam Lake and then further south, the more recent herd that's been established, are doing okay. Maybe not as well as people may have hoped when the reintroduction started back in the 90s. And as a result, both of those herds are being augmented by movement of animals from Kentucky. I think the contract calls for up to 50 animals a year, and they've got a few left on that agreement to augment both of those herds. But movement of elk this year has been suspended because Kentucky needed to use the elk that they were capturing to deal with augmenting a herd within their own state.
Oh.
So there's a temporary suspension, which they fully expect to be lifted, and they'll be back in action again next year, and presumably the Wisconsin herds will continue to grow. So on that front, things are okay. On the predatory animal front, I'm not sure what to tell you. There are no major upheavals in the force. Wolves are, of course, doing very well and remain contentious. The bear population are peacefully sleeping away the winter right now. The bear harvest was down slightly this past year, but that's all part of the give and take in the bear population. The smaller predators, from fox and coyotes and weasels and mink and things like that, not heard of any particular problems there. And what was the other one I was going to mention? Oh, and there was another fairly recent validation of cougar presence with some trail camera photos. So overall, I would say that the our predatory mammals are doing just fine, and there are no particular problems to report that I'm aware of.
Good. Thank you. Yeah.
Did I hear something about moose in Wisconsin, or did you guys already pass that?
No. We were going to talk a little bit
about it.
Moose, not necessarily in Wisconsin. You know, there are a few animals, particularly across northern, northeastern Wisconsin, that trickle in from the UP. But moose are not a big deal here. Where they are a big deal, in New England, northern Minnesota, Isle Royal, places like that, particularly there are a few different problems. We'll come back to Isle Royal in a minute. But in New England, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, that had a pretty good moose population and a pretty successful hunting season built around that, they've been having the same kinds of problems that northern Minnesota has had, where the biggest problem seems to be something called a winter tick, which has been flourishing in recent years. And the infestation that these moose contract is just amazing. I was looking at an article the other day about the moose situation in northern Vermont, and they, I've got my notes right here somewhere, said they were seeing, the researchers who were studying this, were seeing moose with in excess of 50,000 ticks on an individual moose. And this, of course, causes substantial hair loss, blood loss, weight loss, acute anemia, and younger moose in particular, it simply kills them. And they were documenting in excess of 70% mortality rates for basically year-old moose. So recruitment was being hammered. The moose population was declining dramatically. Same problem in northern Minnesota. And as a result, these states are cutting back on their hunting seasons, and the moose populations are on the decline. And I'm not sure they have any idea what to do about it. The situation on Isle Royal is a little different. Up there, as you've probably heard, that's been a long-standing, almost like a closed laboratory for moose-wolf interactions. But the wolf population began to disappear a few years ago, and I think they feel it's down to maybe one individual now.
Wow.
And last year, I guess there were two, but they've had all sorts of inbreeding problems and no augmentation of moose coming across the ice to repopulate. So the moose the wolves are all but gone, and that's allowing the moose population to grow rapidly. And there will be problems there, too. I don't know if they have winter ticks or not, but the research notes that came out of there, and I don't see that article sitting here, but the dead moose that they've collected for many years to study, the skulls are actually becoming smaller within a given age class as the population grows. So they have their own set of problems, and I think they're awaiting a Park Service report or a study group to report that the best thing they can do is bring some wolves over from the mainland and try and restore the wolf population, which will then bring the moose population down. We'll have to see how that plays out. Generally, the Park Service doesn't manipulate populations very much. They're kind of hands-off. So if they start bringing wolves in, this will be a bit of a departure from previous behavior. But we'll see.
We'll see. Thank you so much for calling, Adam. Appreciate it very much. Michael in Bear Valley, it's your turn. Hi, Michael. Michael, are you there? Michael, are you there? Oh, must have lost him.
Can you imagine 50,000 ticks on an animal?
No.
I go nuts when I feel one tick crawling up my leg, and here's an animal with 50,000 of them, and there's not a darn thing they can do about it. Well,
we got a nice photo here of an owl with a rabbit. Now, where did that come from? Mary emailed this photo of an owl with its dinner. A rabbit underneath is a really cool, really cool photo.
Well, keep up the good work, owl. The I could use a little rabbit help around my property.
You can join in, too. The number to call, new number today because we're having problems with our 800 number. It's 608-263-6580, 608-263-6580. Somebody mentioned eagles, and, boy, we've had some really great luck with our eagle population here in this state. We've got eagle watching days coming up. Dave posted on our Facebook page a beautiful photo of two eagles that he took, photo that he took in Nisida near the dams in Nisida. He said he saw 30 eagles there the day after Christmas. So that is really nice. And here we've got eagle watching days coming up the 12th and the 13th in the Prairie du Sac area.
Yes, and that'll be a big deal this year because this is another ramification of this cold weather is that a lot of water has sealed up, and the eagles are more dependent on those dams along the Wisconsin River where the water's still flowing, and they can find fish. So I think they had, the last number I saw was well over 100 eagles over around Prairie du Sac, and they were actually closing one of the popular hiking trails to avoid disturbing the eagles that were sitting in large numbers along the edge of the river. Eagle nests in general were up 5.7% in 2017, which is another record, and I think we're down to just two counties. I know Milwaukee's one, I don't remember the other one, where there's not an active eagle nest in that county. So virtually everybody has got eagles around the state now, and they're doing very well. So the number of occupied nests up to almost 1,600. And, when I came to Wisconsin in the 70s, an eagle was a rare sight. People were pretty uptight about the future of bald eagles, and here
we are.
Here we're doing pretty well again.
And eagle watching days at Sauk Prairie are January 12th and 13th. And if you just go online to type in Eagle Watching Days, Sauk Prairie, or Prairie du Sac, you're going to get the information. They have they release an eagle every year. There's food. There's the opportunity to go and observe the eagles. It's really a very fun event, January 12th and 13th. And there are other eagle watching events as well. Judith in Muskego, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, that was a strange observance at my heated bird bath. There was ice around the edges. So there were these five blackbirds that were taking a bath. They were dipping into the water. And it was like 4 degrees above zero. And I've never seen anything like that. Can you explain that kind of behavior?
See, I thought the strange behavior was going to be that there were still blackbirds around at this time of year. Do you know specifically what they were?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm not one of those callers that can identify.
Okay.
I'm not good at that. All I can tell you is that they were between 5 and 6 inches long, and there were like five, maybe six of them, and they were taking turns taking a bath.
And they were really jet black?
They were jet black. The sun was shining, and it was real pretty out, but it was cold, and they were jet black.
Well, for that size, sounds like red wings, although you might have noticed the red wing patch. But in any event, if the oddity that you're curious about is the bathing, the birds will continue to do that, even in the cold. They need to bathe, and the bathing not only for cleanliness, but to wash off whatever problems, parasites or whatever else they might be concerned about, they'll continue to do that. And that's one of the reasons why a heated bird bath is such a popular feature at this time of year. Water's in short supply, so both for drinking, which the birds need to do as well, and an occasional bath, they get in there and splash around a little bit, and then as they flap and fly, most of the water disappears, and they usually fly up into a tree or bush and keep their wings out a bit until they've dried off, and away they go. It happens, and based on the size you describe, sounds like probably red-winged blackbirds were the most likely. This was just recently?
Oh, it's yesterday.
Yesterday. Yeah. That's pretty recent. Well, I haven't, that's an unusual sighting in and of itself because most of the blackbirds gather up in large flocks, and boy, they're out of here by late summer, early fall. But strange things happen, and people come up with robins and blackbirds and bluebirds and all sorts of things over the course of the winter that people just don't expect to be here.
So, I had a strange sighting at my own yard in my backyard. I looked out, and I looked into the neighbor's backyard, and he was getting into his hot tub, and it was about zero.
Oh. Maybe that's something.
There was a sighting.
Something you
for
don't
your eyes.
Something you don't need to see.
Oh, Judith, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Michael in Bear Valley, we can go back to you. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. Larry, I've got a question for you and Scott. After 40 years of deer hunting out here on our property in Sauk County, we shot what looked like a healthy buck, 8-pointer. It was real nice, good weight, and we tested it, and it came out positive, and that's the first time we've had a positive out here. And I've got a question about disposal of the meat and the body parts and things of that sort, and it's a question about whether or not when you or keep an infected deer in the area, does it spread to other wildlife? And I was wondering if there were any studies done on that, and maybe if you had some suggestions as the best way to dispose of deer that test positive for CWD.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, between my son and I, we've had to do it 5 times over the years. And in all those cases, or most of them at least, we had processed the deer. You couldn't afford to wait between the interval of harvesting the deer and you know, waiting for the test results. So we would process them, which we have a facility to do in the barn, and the meat would be labeled as to which individual deer that was, and into the freezer it would go. And usually the parts left, the hides we usually donate out in Barneveld, so those were gone. Most of the bones and trim and so forth went in trash bags and ultimately to the landfill. And occasionally we would hang up, again, not knowing that the deer at the time was positive, you know, put out a rib cage for the birds to pick at or whatnot. And that was our tactic, generally. And then when the call would come in that, hey, did you get deer such and such a number? Yes, we did. Well, it was positive. Then it was back into the freezer, find all the packages marked from that particular deer, load them into trash bags, and then the next time we went to the disposal center, there went the deer. Now, having said that, the other part of your question was if you've got, you know, a back 40, so to speak, and you throw some material out there, is that a risk to other wildlife? And there's no evidence that it is transmissible to scavengers, predators, or other things that may pick away at it, like the birds. But there may be some problems with other deer contact. So you have to be a little bit careful about that. Obviously, as the ground's frozen, it's too late to bury anything. If you can put them aside, put some of the bones and so forth aside and let them freeze up for the winter until you can bury them or dispose of them in the spring, that's one possibility. But I think the safest thing overall is to get them to the dump, landfill, or whatever opportunity you have in your community and see that they're disposed of.
Yeah.
Mind you, a lot of hunters have basically ignored the testing, and you know, deer are going home, and I'm sure CWD positive deer are being consumed.
Yes.
But again, the risk of transmission to humans, there's no documentation that it has happened, but there's also no absolute guarantee that it can't. So
right.
This is a personal decision, and It got to the point this past fall, you know, there was a pretty well-known sausage processor, I don't remember the name of the company, that made quite a splash when they made an announcement that they were going to stop handling venison in terms of sausage products because they couldn't guarantee that they weren't using CWD-positive meat in their products.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think there's going to be more and more of that in the future, and CWD continues to spread geographically and in terms of prevalence, and it's still a bad situation. It's just fallen off the radar screen a bit in favor of other things for people to think about.
Well, yeah. I would think in the long run it's going to have an effect on hunting practices. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. It's certainly changed, at least where I hunt in Iowa County, not very far from you.
Yeah.
It's changed the composition of the herd. It's changed the way people hunt. It's changed the number of people hunting.
Yes.
You know, opening day, well, I missed the whole darn thing this year because I was sick, but, you know, my son was out kind of on my behalf, and he was reporting back on his cell phone so that I could stay engaged. And, you know, he said, boy, it's, you know, it's hard to know that it's opening day anymore.
Yeah,
there's so little shooting and no more groups of people driving, and a lot of neighbors had quit. And it's just a very different situation. And with all the regulations changes, it's just a very different situation than it was. Larry and I were talking about it before the show.
Yeah.
What we used to love about the deer season and deer camp and heading off to registration to see the guys there and all that stuff is gone now. And supposedly in the name of making deer hunting more fun, but I
don't know.
I have a tough time seeing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the state does have a plan to deal with this situation, or is that on hold as well?
Well, you know, since the Deer Trustee report in 2012, when his call was for a more passive approach to CWD, things kind of went quiet for a while. But the, I've got a news report here somewhere that says, what did it say? It said that the CWD report... Oh, I don't see it here right now, but the CWD report that's been called for has been delayed by a couple of months, but there will be a new plan coming out, and I don't know what the elements of the plan will be.
No.
But there's been no miracle cure has been developed in the last few years. There's still a lot of uncertainty as to what can be done about it.
No. Michael, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rod in Arlington, we go to you. Hi, Rod.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I noticed something here in the last week or two. We have a healthy crop of blue jays that come to our feeders, and I feed sunflower seeds and regular seed, also suet. But I do throw out unsalted peanuts in the shell.
And the blue jays love them, don't they?
Oh, it keeps them away from the other feeders so the other birds can eat. But the thing is, I noticed recently, normally I would see them take those and hop up in a tree or fly off to a tree not too far away, and they would eat the peanuts right away. And in the last week or so, I've noticed them stashing them in places, including the ground, which I never saw before. And I wondered, do they really remember where they stashed this stuff?
Well, that's kind of the $64,000 question with squirrels burying nuts and assorted other things. And the reality is that as people have tried to study this or plot out where the nuts are buried, hidden, or whatever, yes, how they do it, I can't explain to you, but... You know, the squirrels, whether it's a sense of smell, the blue jays is a sense of memory, they do find at least enough of these caches to make the behavior worthwhile. In other words, if they were flying off with all your peanuts and scattering them hither, thither, and yon and never found any of them again, then that really doesn't do them any good. So it's an energetic loss for the blue jays. So they've got to be finding enough of them when they need them that... it works out for them. Now, I could put out, I've got one family group of, I think it's six jays, and I kind of enjoy seeing them, but I could stand there on the back deck and throw out a handful of peanuts from the bucket, and those birds are incredibly efficient, and those peanuts will be gone in 15 minutes. I could throw out another handful, and they'd be gone. And much like you observed, they're hauling them away and caching them somewhere. Now, whether they get to the point that say, hey, guys, you know, we got 800 pounds of peanuts in this hollow tree here. Maybe we should back off. I doubt it. I think as long as there's nuts out there, they'll continue to remove them. So
I wondered if they maybe had some kind of internal GPS they used that they locked it in their little brains, and because I know some of them have been hidden along the areas where I have retaining walls at the base of those, and they push them down inside in the cracks. and fly away and then go grab another one and head off someplace else. So
I think rather than something analogous to a GPS, what they have is tremendous familiarity with their particular environment. And if that's your backyard and three or four other backyards, or in my case, a 10-acre lot with tree corridors on the sides where they tend to spend their time, they know where they are at any given time, and I think they have a pretty good idea where they're leaving those nuts. And the good news is that those nuts that they don't find or don't use are often found by squirrels, chipmunks, mice, and assorted other things, so they don't necessarily go to waste. And of course, if they were gathering normal wild-produced nuts, be they acorns or hickory nuts or whatever, and were stashing those or leaving some in the ground, then that's a form of seed dispersal for those trees. So yeah. It all is kind of linked into a pretty slick system.
I think so as well. Thank you so much, Rod.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven. Always great to have Scott come along. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW Madison. And Scott, we got Joe and Viroqua coming up next. But before we do get to Joe, any comments on the wrap up of the deer season?
Well, we mentioned briefly the bear harvest at just over 4,000 animals, down a little bit. The deer season, we've kind of beaten around the bush on that. It was for all intents and purposes, pretty much the same in terms of numbers as last year. There are a couple of trends that are worth noting. Crossbow harvest continues to increase dramatically. License sales were down again, which is, of course, of great concern to the agencies. And as we talked about with the caller a few minutes ago, CWD just keeps marching on. So that kind of takes care of the deer situation. The one that I wanted to mention was what was a disappointing fall for a lot of folks I talked to as far as grouse were concerned in the North Woods.
Yeah, it was a
bad
year.
The talk early on, late summer, early fall, was that, the surveys were up in the spring. Not dramatically, but up. And there was a lot of optimism. Boy, it's going to be a good grouse hunting season in the North Woods. And although some people found pockets of birds and did very well, overall, the vast majority of the people I talked to were really disappointed. I had a group of eight old grad school buddies up at the cabin in October before I got sick, and they tromped all over the place and found virtually nothing in areas where traditionally we would find birds. So once all was said and done and people began to compare notes, I talked to a few other folks around my place in Price County. One guy in particular who was brought up around Phillips and had been was an avid grouse hunter, 51 years of grouse hunting, and knew what he was doing. And his comment was, I hunted for a week or two in October, and there were so few birds that the notion of shooting one with as few as there were just seemed unacceptable. He said, I quit for the season. And he cited other friends in the area who had felt the same way, which was very disappointing. So bottom line, what the heck happened? And there was a lot of soul searching about that as well. And I think the primary explanation were those horrendous rains we had late spring and into June that probably took out most of the broods. And then there was some work, I think, out of the UP in Michigan that determined that grouse were also vulnerable to West Nile virus. And then there was some speculation, boy, I wonder if that's playing a role or will in the future. So whatever happened, it was a disappointing year. And here, when we should have been a couple years into the upswing of the 10-year cycle, we got knocked back, and that perhaps doesn't bode well for the next cyclic peak. We'll see. Things could turn around and they have a fabulous spring and we're back to more normal, but it was a disappointment.
Well, probably my favorite bird to eat.
Well, they're beautiful and they're really good on the dinner table.
Yeah. Joe in Viroqua. Thanks for
good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have 2 points to make. The first week in December, I was walking around a man-made lake in Vernon County. It was in a protected bay on a sunny side, and I spotted 3 or 4 mud turtles sitting on logs. And it just blew my mind that that would occur in December.
Yeah.
Hard to believe.
It is, but, then, you know, strange things happen, and wildlife takes advantage of opportunity. And it was reasonably warm into early December, and any of those turtles that were on the bottom and you know, in a dark bottom on an area where they got some sun said, hey, this isn't so bad. Let's go sit in the sun for a little while. Yeah, why not? Anyway, what's
it? Just amazed me.
Yeah. What's your other point, Joe?
The other point is if you have a bird of prey and songbirds in the same area, and the birds would be in view of the hawk will not attack unless those birds make a movement. I think a movement triggers the hawk.
Certainly, but if, you know, it doesn't take, it only takes one bird to kind of break ranks and either decide to go grab a seed after all or attempt to fly away, and that may be enough to get the hawk moving, and then once the hawk's moving, everybody's moving, and pandemonium breaks out. So I guess the thing to convey is that hawks have been around for a long time, and so have the songbirds that they feed on. And things have worked out. There are only just so many predators and lots of prey, and the system works. So while it's difficult for someone feeding birds to see a cardinal or finch or something they like watching taken by a hawk, it happens. The hawk's got to eat, and come next year, there'll still only be a relatively few hawks and plenty of songbirds. So
yeah,
not necessarily a disaster.
Thank you so much for calling, Joe.
I should point out, related to that, Larry, while we've got just a second here, I would, you know, I don't have the numbers to back this up, but for people who are feeding, I think the number of birds that fall prey to our windows
is much higher.
Is probably higher than what the hawks are taking. And we hear an occasional thud and rush out on the deck, and there may or may not be a bird sitting there, but this happened 4 or 5 days ago, and I heard a big thunk on the living room window, went around to the deck, and, you know, there was a female downy woodpecker lying there in the snow, wings out. I said, well, it's still alive, so I went out, picked it up, brought it in, put it on a towel in a shoebox, and left it in the sun in a sunny window for about 30 minutes, and went back and kind of opened the box a little bit, and that bird was just squawking like crazy. And I grabbed it, and it was at that point, it had warmed up. It hadn't broken a neck or wing or anything else, and I just opened the door, and
way
it
went.
Was gone like a flash. So, you know, don't necessarily give up on those birds that hit your windows. If you can bring them in and get them warm and they're not mortally injured, you can usually let them go.
Margaret in Kokana, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I had an interesting experience this morning while listening to your show. I saw this large object in my hawthorn tree up on the edge of my, and I thought it was a squirrel's nest, but I got my binoculars out, and it was a bird. And at first, I thought it was an eagle because of the coloration of a light head, and the inside of the tail was white, and then the darker body. But when I looked at the face, it looked more like the shape of an owl. And it's been flying around for a good chunk of the last hour or so. Now it's disappeared. But the coloration, the wings were kind of light. So I wasn't sure if it was a barred owl or if I saw a snowy owl. But it was a big bird. I mean, it was almost the size of an eagle.
A barred owl is a pretty good-sized bird, too, mostly feathers, but pretty good size. A snowy owl really should have been distinctively white.
Okay.
And there have been, I mean, that's a good segue. There have been a lot of sightings of snowy owls,
yeah,
again across the northern states. And I think as of, a week or so ago into December, I think there were something like 170-some sightings in Wisconsin. But you really should have been able to identify a snowy owl immediately by the generally white plumage. But what else you saw? A barred owl would be a good guess, yeah, because they're so common. And seeing one out in the day while it's a little unusual. I mean, the bottom line is they're active at night, but they've got to be somewhere during the day. So I commonly flush them out of my pine trees during the day where they're just hanging out. So it's not that unusual.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen barred owls during the day before when I was deer hunting.
Yeah.
So, but I've never seen them. We live out in the middle of, there's no hardly any trees where we live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's all open fields. We're not too far from the Fox River. We're about maybe a mile and a half from the Fox River.
Yeah.
Well, there are other species, like long-eared, short-eared owls and so forth. If you look in the bird book at what you saw, these birds tend to be in open, you know, prairie farmland kind of country and more active during the day. So it may have been a little more unusual owl than just the run-of-the-mill barred owl.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest, Kristen, will answer this question after our news break, has a great photo of a bird, wonders if it's a gray jay, and we'll find that out. And go take a look at it on our Facebook page right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Scott's with us till 12:30. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the World of Wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He's resided in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology for a long, long time. Comes by every other month to talk with us about the world of wildlife, and I hope you'll join in. As I mentioned earlier, our 800 number is not working today, but we do have another number you can use, and that number is 608-263-6580, 608-263-6580. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. You can also go to our Facebook page and post photos and questions there. And you can email questions to ideas@wpr.org. And Scott, just before the break, we had this great photo. I mentioned that we had a photo from Kristen of her or somebody holding a bird, or it's at least sitting on the person's hand, wondering if it is a gray jay. And it sure is.
Drum roll, please. Yes, it is a gray jay, or fondly known in the Northwoods as a whiskey jack, but they're pretty birds. They're notoriously tame, and they do make a great feeder bird. So, yes, that's what it is.
But we don't have gray jays here.
Not down here.
No.
Further north. I had a friend in Fifield, Wisconsin, who had quite a population of them, and he fed them quarter-pound sticks of margarine. And they loved it. He made little feeders out of hardware cloth that he could just slide a frozen stick of margarine into. So in the fall or late, whenever cheap margarine went on sale for 30 cents a pound, he'd go buy 50 pounds of it, put it in the freezer, and then all he'd have to do is unwrap a quarter-pound stick, slide it in these little wire cylinders, and the gray jays just loved it.
We had Lorraine on Facebook post a photo of two bluebirds visiting her heated bird bath. She's wondering why they haven't migrated yet.
Who knows? That's, you know, as we were saying back when the caller called about the blackbirds at a feeder, there's not a winter that goes by when people don't see bluebirds, robins, blackbirds, you know, things that should be gone. But either they didn't leave for some reason, you know, one was injured, they've recovered. In the case of robins, they usually find a spring that's open and has some food resources, and there are several areas in the state notorious for that, like the springs on Lake Winger in the Arboretum. There are often robins there all winter. So these things happen, and they're part of the fascination with wildlife, that oddball stuff shows up where you don't expect it, and hey, it's pretty cool. You try and figure out the reason, but nobody is ever going to figure it out.
You know, you mentioned earlier that there were only two counties you thought that didn't have an eagle nest. Ron in Crandon emailed to say he believed an eagle nest was spotted in Kenosha. So that leaves only Milwaukee County without an eagle sighting. So.
And it may be. I heard about the one in Kenosha, but the county that, let me see if I can read my map here. Where is that?
There's a different county.
Oh, I thought there was a different one, but we may be down to just one.
That'd be very cool.
I see Milwaukee down there with the big donut, but and Kenosha does have a one in the map, but I thought I'd seen another zero, and now I don't know where it is. So maybe we're down to just one. So either way, there are a lot of eagles in Wisconsin now, so
yeah,
for people who enjoy watching them, they're out there.
Doug in Fond du Lac emailed to suggest the blackbirds in the caller's bird bath may be European starlings. They're very common residents, do have a green iridescent sheen. The icterid blackbirds almost all exhibit blue-purple iridescence. There is a chance they were Brewer's blackbirds. Yeah?
Well, possible on the Brewers, that's possible, but I hadn't thought about the starlings, and they're around a lot more regularly than some of the other blackbirds, especially if the caller was anywhere near a farm where there may have been blackbirds using the cattle feed and barns and so forth. That's a good possibility. And they are about 6 inches long and kind of stocky, so good call by the listeners.
Good call. Let's go to John in Waseca next. Hi, John.
Hi, I was just listening to Scott's comment about the ruffed grouse population declining in northern Wisconsin, and as we know, it's really declined in southern Wisconsin. I live between Waseca and Boscobel, and was one of the first release sites on my property for wild turkeys when they were brought into Wisconsin. Paul Bryant, the wildlife biologist out of Boscobel, was doing some releases there, and if I remember right, we were trading ruffed grouse to Missouri for these wild turkeys.
Yep, four grouse for one turkey.
Yes, and Missouri was kind of ahead of us in promoting the great wild turkey hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can attest that the grouse population on my property and surrounding properties dropped as the wild turkeys populated. I know there's been a study out of UW-Richland and attributed to habitat, but a few years ago, 10 years ago, the price of red oaks went crazy high. There was a lot of slash cutting in southern Wisconsin, which was great habitat, better than it was in the 70s, and I don't hear a grouse coming. But anytime I can look out my window and see 50 to 60 turkeys mm-hmm. in the soybean field next to me.
Yep.
You've got this light snow that's on the ground right now. If I go into my woods, there's not a spot that a turkey has. I mean, when 50 to 60 turkeys go through a 10-acre parcel of hardwood.
Oh, they're like little bulldozers.
They've every spot. I've also raised domestic turkeys, and they're great egg predators. I've watched wild turkeys eat snakes, rodents, and I just can't believe that it's not. They're somehow related, that as these turkeys move through the woods, that they're not devastating ruffed grouse.
Well, what you say, John, certainly makes some sense, and it's often difficult to tease out the relationships when one species of wildlife, one type of animal is flourishing, when concurrently something else is disappearing. I think it's only human nature to assume that, well, there's got to be some association there. What the heck is it? But, you know, the folks, I have no firsthand experience to draw on, except I used to hunt ruff when I first moved to Wisconsin in the early 1970s. I hunted grouse a lot in Iowa County, and we had fantastic grouse hunting. There were grouse all over the place.
Yeah.
And They've simply vanished. I've not seen on that same farm where I still hunt deer, I've not heard or seen a grouse for
years.
Not one. And I know the folks who did the Richland Center work, UW-Richland work, and they have a very compelling argument that habitat change and predator complex and hunting pressure and a lot of things all conspired to pretty much drive the birds out of southwestern Wisconsin. And although the association, wow, turkeys were going nuts while grouse were disappearing, something must be going on. But I've never seen anyone be able to document that either, you know, radio-marked broods of grouse were consumed by marauding turkeys or anything like that. That just hasn't happened. I'm not saying that there aren't isolated cases where, you know, turkeys are pecking along and, whoa, here's a brood of grouse, yeah, you know, one-day-old grouse chicks buzzing around that, you know, maybe one gets picked up. But in terms of the overall relationship, it just doesn't seem to be there, even though it makes sense that it should be. So
yeah, there you go.
Anyway, we've got turkeys, and we're going to have turkeys. And
watch, when the releases first were done on my land, I was told, well, southwest Wisconsin is the only place turkeys will survive. We're not going to see them move north. Well, obviously that's not true. I see them clear up to Green Bay and beyond.
Oh, they're all the way to Lake Superior.
Yeah. They are all the way to Lake Superior. They
prove to be a lot more flexible and a lot more adaptable and viable than anyone realized. So the turkey explosion has, since that reintroduction, has been is considered one of the great wildlife success stories in the state. But a lot of it was, sure, the original releases, the trades with Missouri and so forth, got it all started. And there were lots of birds moved around by the DNR to populate other areas of the state. But the turkeys for the last few years have done a lot of it on their own. So,
and I'm mad at myself that I didn't get out here for this last end of the season, end of the year, which I've had some good luck in past years. But No luck this year. John, thank you for a call. I want to give some others a chance to join in. Carol in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering if you can talk about herons in Wisconsin. The reason I'm asking is because I know of a spot where there's about 80 nests, and it's on the side of a roadway. And I'm always kind of worried about those nests should any future development occur. So I'm also wondering if there's any reason to protect them, and if so, how.
Those nests, are they great blues? Are they green?
I think they're great blues.
That's certainly, I mean, they're very common, and they're very visible, and they're very large. Well, those nesting colonies, or rookeries as they're called, are very important for the herons in a given area. They return there to nest, they return there to roost, and then they scatter around the local countryside to ponds and marshes and wetlands to feed during the day. So the fact that they're concentrated in a small area like that, even though that may represent most of the great blue herons for, you know, a reasonable number of square miles around, it makes them vulnerable to anything from natural disturbances like windstorms or whatnot to, hey, we're going to widen the road and these old dead trees have got to go. Generally speaking, most heron rookeries are pretty well known to the wildlife management community, and to the extent that they can be protected, they are. I think if you're concerned about them, number one, I would get a hold of a county plat book for the county you're in and find out what the land ownership of that land is that the rookery is on. And if it's public land, that's one thing. If it's a private landowner, you could certainly go talk to find the landowner and see, hey, what do you think of those herons and so forth. The other thing I'd recommend is that you just make a phone call to your local county wildlife manager. Say, I'm a little bit concerned about the heron rookery out on the side of County Highway XYZ or whatever it is. between such and such a road and such and such a road, chances are they're going to know about it, and they will give you some information on, well, we're trying to get an easement on that property, or we're trying to buy the property, or the landowner is very aware of them and concerned about it, and you'll have a much better idea of whether the herons need some further attention or whether they don't.
And how do you get a hold of your local wildlife manager?
I think if you just go on the DNR website and dial into a county,
Carroll's in Madison. So
yeah, so your local wildlife manager in Dane County is Julie Widholm, and at the Nevin Fish Hatchery, and you can easily find those numbers, and away you go.
Yeah, makes good sense. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too at 608-263-6580. Back to Facebook for a minute. Kathy posted a nice photo. I've had this pair of quail at my feeder for a couple of years, she says. So that's kind of nice to have some quail.
That is nice. I mean, we're really on the northern fringe of their range in a winter like this. Obviously, they're doing very well at a feeder, which is important to them. But I would say, you know, Larry, over the 20 years I've lived on that land south of Madison, early on, oh, I'd say 2 years out of three, we'd have a couple of whistling Bob Whites on the property there. But I don't believe it's probably been 5 or 6 years since I heard one, and I kind of miss them. They're nice to have around. So in this case, the photographer is very lucky, and hopefully they'll make it through this cold spell and be around.
I had another question for you, but it just slipped my mind. So let's go to Dan in River Falls next.
Okay.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I'm not a turkey hunter. I'll confess that. I've always wanted to. But with so many turkey that we have, why do we only have such a low limit? I think I just look up the regulations, one in the fall and one in the spring, when we can have, I don't know, at least two pheasants a day after a certain date, and up to five, I think, for grouse. Well, it doesn't make sense to me at all.
In fact, the limit is placed on turkeys by the tags or permits that they issue in a given year. But in most areas where turkeys are abundant, there are numerous surplus tags, and there's no limit on how many you can buy at the rate of one a day. So I usually have two, three, or four tags, sometimes for different units or within the same unit, to spread out the opportunity to hunt a little bit. And I'm trying to think, there was an article in the paper. What the heck? Trying to remember how many turkeys this individual hunter had registered, and that information's all available on the DNR website now. I want to say it was 30 or 40 turkeys over the last 10 years that this one individual had legally harvested. So the actual number you're limited to is only limited by the number of permits you want to buy or can buy. So it's certainly more than one in most areas where they're abundant.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Bill in St. Germain, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi.
What can we do for you today?
Well, I hope Scott gets well.
Yeah, yeah. Scott hopes the same thing.
Yeah, my wife and I were going into town. We saw a wolf standing in the middle of our road on the 21st of December. Just one.
Mm-hmm.
We were wondering what they were eating now, because we saw turkeys a little ways down the road.
Well, wolves will, first of all, it's a nice sighting. A lot of people live or vacation in the Northwoods for a long time and never get to see a wolf, so that's pretty cool in and of itself. In terms of what they're eating, whatever they can get a hold of. This time of year, there are still, with the deer season not that far behind us, and I think the archery season's still on, actually, yeah. I think for a few days. I would guess that most of the wolves are doing pretty well finding gut piles and the remains of deer that may have been wounded and got away, or the gut piles that are left behind after the deer are harvested and dragged out of the woods. That's a big source of food. other wildlife of all forms. They like beavers when they can get a hold of them, which is not uncommon. But and they may, you know, bring down or find wounded or sick or slow deer, as well as, you know, literally any other animal in the North Woods is a potential dinner as far as the wolves are concerned, if they can get a hold of them.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Alan Porterfield, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm calling. You know, people are talking about hawks hitting their bird feeders and everything, and I take a CD and put it on a fishing line with a little fishing swivel, and I got them all over my property, and it stopped the owl attacks, hawk attacks, because we got chickens and everything. And it scares them away because they're always moving and they pick up any light, but it really works good.
Oh, that's a pretty good tip. If you, but that doesn't seem to bother the birds at the feeders?
No, it don't.
Huh.
The food's there. They come in. I got one right by the feeder.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could use that technique to prevent window mortality. If you hung a couple of them right up against the window, if that might help.
Well, somebody said you put these little sticky things on the windows, like crystals or something on your windows, and that prevents them from hitting a lot of your windows. Hmm.
Well, good tip on the hawks and owls.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see if we got one other caller here. Leslie in Tomahawk. Your turn. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I just had a suggestion for a book to read. I heard someone called in about a starling, and I know starlings are a much maligned bird, but there's a little tiny book called Mozart's Starling, and it's a true story about Mozart and how he raised a starling, and the author of the book was so intrigued by it, she rescued her own baby starling and raised it, and this book is about that journey that she took with this bird, which I have a whole much larger respect for the starlings after reading it, and it's fun and how smart they are and actually how beautiful of a book bird they are. So just kind of a neat thing, and it's called Mozart's Starling. Anyone who likes birds or loves birds should really read it.
Oh, Mozart's Starling.
I'll have to find that. Thank you. That's a very nice tip, and it's a very good point that people need to realize that birds, mammals, snakes, a lot of different types of wildlife often suffer from some social stigma that, oh, they're bad or they're ugly or they do damage or whatever, when in reality, an individual animal of any of these species, either as a youngster or an injured animal that someone gets a hold of and sees that it gets proper care, can be a pretty neat thing to be involved with. They're not necessarily, there are really no bad animals. They're just doing what they've evolved into doing. And it's a human construct to think that they're bad because they happen to be preying on other animals or living in our attic or whatever else.
Yeah. So. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Scott, the next time you're on, you'll be able to talk with us about your tour of Yellowstone.
Oh, yes. I'll be just back from leading a winter tour or helping lead a winter tour in Yellowstone with my good friend from Door County, the noted travel guide Paul Renier, used to be at the Ridges Sanctuary. We'll be going together out to lead a tour into Yellowstone on the snowcat vehicles from the northern part of the park into Old Faithful. And if I don't freeze to death, it should be a lot of fun.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today. Scott Craven, our guest, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, works out of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. He'll be back on March 7th. Tomorrow, our consumer protection specialists join us. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.